From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It's so, so very important. I can't imagine any course of study that would be more important, for it's the story of human history and humankind, and if we're going to go forward, we have to know where we've been. There's no such thing as making a significant stride forward without knowing what the pitfalls are and what the dangers are, what problems might beset you, and I think that history can help us understand those pitfalls and problems, and I've sought to teach that in my courses and in my writings.
The late Dr. John Hope Franklin. Franklin was the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of History, and for 7 years was Professor of Legal History in the Law School at Duke University. A native of Oklahoma and a graduate of Fisk University, he received the MA and PhD degrees in history from Harvard University. He taught at some of the most prestigious institutions, including Fisk, St. Augustine College, North Carolina Central University, and Howard University. In 1956, he went to Brooklyn College as chairman of the Department of History. And in 1964, he joined the faculty of the University of Chicago, serving as chairman of the History Department from 1967 to 1970. At the University of Chicago, he was the John Mather Manley Distinguished Service Professor from 1969 to 1982, when he became Professor Emeritus. During the Civil Rights era, Franklin helped prepare the landmark Supreme Court case for Brown v. Board of Education. And in 1965, he marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery, Alabama. On March 25, 2009, Franklin died of congestive heart failure. He was 94. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Dr. John Hope Franklin, In Black America.
I give you that as a background to the next experience I had in Ithaca. As the summer drew to a close, I received a call from Thurgood Marshall. I had known Thurgood for a number of years, since 1948. When I worked with him in the successful effort to open the University of Kentucky. The case of Lyman Johnson against the University of Kentucky is not cited very often. People speak of sweat, they speak of gains, they speak of the cases that arose in Oklahoma, the Sipule case and the McLaurin case. They don't speak of this case. Perhaps it is because Lyman Johnson, a graduate of the Kentucky State College for Negroes, applied to do graduate work in history at the University of Kentucky. This was 2 years before Sweat against Painter.
The late John Hope Franklin was a prolific scholar of African American history who profoundly influenced thinking about slavery and Reconstruction. During a career of scholarship, teaching, and advocacy that spanned more than 60 years, he was deeply involved in the debate that helped reshape America's racial identity, working with the likes of W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurgood Marshall, Carter G. Woodson, and other legends of the 20th century. Franklin broke numerous color barriers. He was the first African-American department chair at a predominantly white institution, Brooklyn College, the first African-American professor to hold an endowed chair at Duke University, and the first African-American president of the American Historical Association. Born on January 2, 1915, in an all-black town in Oklahoma, he wasn't content to sit on the sidelines while African-Americans struggled for equality. He marched on Selma. He met with presidents. He consulted with the attorneys who would argue Brown v. Board of Education in the U.S. Supreme Court. With his help, they were able to convince the justices that separate was inherently unequal. As an African-American, he lived the history he documented, from Jim Crow to the election of the first African-American president. Franklin also believed, however, that even as they study the past, historians have a role to play in shaping the future. Franklin left a profound legacy rooted in hope. In April 2004, In Black America spoke with this noted historian.
Well, I was born in a village that had a very few people in it, maybe 100 or so. And I lived there until I was 6 years old, until I was 10 years old. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a lawyer. They soon found that he couldn't make a decent living in a small town like that. And so he went to Tulsa in 1921 to open a law office there. And we were to follow him as soon as school was out. But at the end of the term, that is on the 1st of June 1921, when we were waiting for him to come and get us to move us to Tulsa, he didn't come. And we waited several days and he didn't come. My mother then read in the newspaper that there was a race riot in Tulsa. There were many casualties and we feared that something might have happened to him. Shortly thereafter, we got a letter from him in which he said he was not harmed, but he had been seized and put in detention shortly after the riot began, and that's why we hadn't heard from him. And when he got out of detention, he went back to where he had a house and where his office also was located in the same area. And it was all flattened to the ground. He lost everything that he had except the things on his back. He didn't have any change of clothes or anything. And his office had been destroyed by the rioters. So we learned what terror was fairly early. And it meant, of course, that he couldn't have us come there then. He didn't have anywhere to put us or anything. He came to see us shortly after that and told us that he couldn't move us then. He was very busy trying to recoup the losses as well as suing the city and the state and the insurance companies for the losses of his clients. Those suits were, of course, to no avail. The courts paid no attention to his suits. So we stayed in that village until I was 10, which of course meant that educational opportunities were limited. My mother supplemented what was in the school with her teaching us at home. And when we finally moved to Tulsa and rejoined my father, who had come down visiting periodically, we went to Tulsa in 1925, in December 1925. I entered the seventh grade then. I was 10 years old in the seventh grade. And I graduated from high school right there in Tulsa as a valedictorian of the high school class, and where I was actively engaged in planning to go to college and then to go to law school, come back and help my father in his law practice. I would, with my additional knowledge and my initiative, I thought I could build it up and we could become a big law firm. But in college, I went to Fisk University. I ran into a white professor at college who was the chairman of the history department and a professor. I heard him lecture. And he was a very young, vigorous man, just not in his late 20s. And I was so impressed with him that I decided to major in history.
How did you get to Fisk? Why did you select Fisk?
My brother had gone to Fisk, and okay. I admired him. I wouldn't do anything my brother would do. My mother and father had both gone to school in Nashville, Tennessee, where Fisk University was located, but they went to Roger Williams University, which no longer existed, and they thought it was a good idea for me to go to school in Nashville. And I thought it was a wonderful idea to go to school where my brother had gone, so I chose Fisk.
And from Fisk, you attended Harvard?
I went to Harvard University Graduate School in 1935 at the age of 20. We were still in dire poverty, and the depression had come, and my father was broke. And my young white professor borrowed the money in Nashville, Tennessee from a bank and lent it to me and said that money will not keep you out of Harvard. And so I had been admitted to Harvard and I went on to graduate school there in the fall of 1935. I had to work hard there, as I had done in Nashville and Fisk. I had two jobs in Fisk, and I had two jobs in Harvard. I was washing dishes for one of my at one of the clubs for my evening meal, which was really a great remuneration. I couldn't have paid for the kind of wonderful food I got there. Then I was typing dissertations for people at Harvard, and I made my way that way with the money I'd borrowed and a little money my father could send me. So I made it through the first year, after which I had fellowships, and I didn't have any financial problems after my first year.
Were there other African Americans at Harvard when you attended?
There were very few. There were two in the English department, two in the biology department, three in the law school, and there were none in any of my classes, none in the history department, and there were none in the medical school, none in the business school, none in the school of education. Just a few, less than 20.
When you studied history at Harvard on a graduate level, give us an idea of the coursework that was involved.
Well, my first year at Harvard, I took a survey course in American intellectual history. I took a survey course in world economic history, and I had a seminar in American intellectual history. I later took world economic history, and I later took American diplomatic history, and took a history of the West, and I took medieval English constitutional history also. Those are the principal courses that I took. I specialized in American history since 1789. In preparation for my oral exams for the PhD, I had British history, American history, and early American history and later American history, and history of the West. And I passed my orals in the spring of 1938, in the spring of 1939, and then began to work on my PhD dissertation, which was on free Negroes in North Carolina. And I went to North Carolina to do my research, and I worked there in the spring and summer of 1939. Broke the back of my research and got a job teaching at St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I did research and taught a full program there in 39-40, and I got married in 41 to my college girlfriend, and in 1940 I got married, and in 1941 I finished my PhD and got my degree.
Why did you select as your dissertation Free Negroes in North Carolina?
Well, it was the process of elimination. At first I wanted to do British history, but I didn't think I'd ever have a chance to go to Britain, and one would have to go to England to do any kind of fundamental research in British history. And in 1935, England looked about as far as Mars or Venus or the moon, and so that was not practical. And then I wanted to do work in the field of American social history. I wanted to do work on the social gospel crowd, but I learned that someone was already working on that. And I had worked, Professor Curry, this white man at Fisk, had encouraged me to work on Free Negroes, and I had written a paper, even when I was a senior at Fisk, on Free Negroes in the antebellum South. And I remembered that, and I was fascinated by it, and after that process of elimination of these other two areas in which I was interested in doing work, the Free Negroes in the antebellum period appealed to me, and that's how I happened to dig up the paper that I wrote when I was in college, and I said, this going to be expanded on, and that's what I did.
In your opinion, why is the study of history an important academic subject to endure oneself with?
Well, it's so, so very important. I can't imagine any course of study that would be more important, for it's the story of human history and humankind, and if we're going to go forward, we have to know where we've been. There's no such thing as making a significant stride forward without knowing what the pitfalls are and what the dangers are, what problems might beset you, and I think that history can help us understand those pitfalls and problems, and I've sought to teach that in my courses and in my writings.
Are we doing a better job of inclusiveness in the history in which we teach our young people today?
I think we might be doing a slightly better job, but we're not doing the best job we can do. We're not nearly as inclusive as we should be. And the result is that we think of the United States largely in terms of groups, separate groups of people. And as a world, we think largely in terms of small nations, or little nations, or parts of the world. We can't integrate the history of the world any more than we can integrate the history of the United States. And until we do, we are doomed to look at ourselves in segments, look at the world in pieces, and therefore not have a grasp of our whole community, our whole nation, or our whole world.
Are there any other individuals that were mentors to you in the development of who John Hope Franklin is today?
Well, there were. My mother and father were, of course, my greatest mentors. I was fortunate to have an educated mother and father. And they, of course, were my greatest tutors until I got to college. In college, not only was Professor Currier a very important mentor of mine, but Professor Lorenzo Turner, who taught me freshman English, was important. Several others, E. Franklin Frazier was in sociology and so forth. But in addition to that, I had people at Harvard. My great mentor there was Arthur Schlesinger Sr., who was one of the senior people in the Department of History. And Paul Buck, on whom I wrote my dissertation, was a very careful guide and teacher and mentor. And I fancied myself also as having mentors whom I didn't know very well, but who had great influence on me through their writings and so forth, such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson, whom I got to know, and so-called father of African-American history, and people like that. So that, I walked on the shoulders of many people. They held me up, and I was very flattered by the attention which some of them gave me.
You've written numerous books, sir. Is there any one particular book that stands out that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm not proud of any of the books that I've written. I'm best known for a book, the History of African America, called From Slavery to Freedom. But my favorite book of all the books that I've written is a book on George Washington Williams. George Washington Williams was a young African American who lived in the middle of the 19th century. He was born in 1849. He went to Western Pennsylvania. He reached almost early manhood at a time when which was very important in the 1850s, early 60s, but a time which a situation in which he didn't find any opportunities to be educated very early. So when he volunteers for the Civil War in 1863, he can barely write his name. He set his age up He wasn't eligible in terms of age. He set his age up and took the name of one of the neighbors and passed himself off as an 18-year-old, which he was not. And he went in the Army and served in several battles in Virginia and was wounded, discharged, reenlisted at the end of the war in the 10th Cavalry and served out in what is now Fort Sill in Oklahoma. And there he also was wounded. He was shot in the left lung there, not in the line of duty. And there was a court-martial. I don't know quite what the results were, although I have the records of part of the court-martial. But he was discharged, and he then went to study at Howard University. He wanted to be a preacher, and he was admitted there, but things seemed to be a little slow there for him, so he quit there and went up to Newton Theological Institution in Massachusetts. Newton was one of the leading theological institutions in the country at the time. And you must remember that this young man was almost illiterate, but he went there. He would not admit it. He appealed to the faculty and appeared before the faculty and pleaded his own case. And he was admitted not to the regular program, but admitted to what is called the English course, kind of a remedial program. And he did so well in that program that he, the following year, was put in the class with his regular classmates who had been admitted the year before. And he then went on and made excellent grades and graduated and was the spokesman for the class. He gave the commencement oration. He was ordained as a minister, and the rest is history. He became a minister. He then became an editor. He then became a politician, was elected to the Ohio legislature. And then he became a historian. He wrote a history of the Negro troops, a history of the Negroes in America, two volumes. Then he wrote a history of the Negro troops in the rebellion. And he wrote many pamphlets and articles and so forth. And he became a prominent person in this country and became prominent abroad. His book was reviewed, first really major piece of writing of an American of any kind. He wrote two volumes, you see, and another volume, with big publishers and so forth. And so by the 1880s, he was kind of a toast of this country, admired greatly by people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who was just getting started, admired by others. And he got interested in foreign affairs. He was appointed United States Minister to Haiti. He was confirmed by the Senate and then not permitted to go because of some scandals brewing about him. And he was not, his commission to go to Haiti was withheld. Then he got interested in Africa and in the various imperial activities in Africa. He went to Belgium, became acquainted with King Leopold of the Belgians, and then he wanted to go to Belgium, the Belgian Congo, to look into matters there. He did go, thanks to subvention by Collis Huntington, the great railroad magnate, and he got over there and found out how terrible conditions were and how responsible he felt Leopold of Belgium was for these terrible conditions. And so he wrote an open letter to Leopold, the King of the Belgians. He called him everything. He wrote a report to the President of the United States on what he had found in the Congo. And he then had shot his bolt there. Collis Huntington withheld support from him from that point on. He went around the Cape and up the west coast of, I'm sorry, up the east coast of Africa to Egypt, where he lectured before the Egyptian Geographical Society. Then he took a boat back to England, and on the boat he met a young woman. He had been married, but he'd separated from his wife, and probably not divorced. I can't find no proof of divorce. But he took up with an English woman on the boat, on board ship, and they sailed on. They arrived in England together. Then he got sick in London, and this English woman took him to Blackpool for the sea air, and he died there with her. She didn't die, but he did. She was prostrate for days mm-hmm. in mourning. But he was 41 years old. He'd done all that by that time. Mm-hmm. His body was not brought back to this country, and he was buried in Blackpool, England. I followed him. I began to follow him in the early 1940s. And I followed him off and on, did research on him for 40 years. And I published his biography of him in 1985. And it was reviewed widely. It was published by the University of Chicago Press. It was later republished by the Duke University Press, still in print. And it's my favorite book.
Dr. Franklin, we're here at the 18th Annual Human Sweat Symposium on Civil Rights in Austin, discussing Brown versus Board of Education, its 50th anniversary. But to get from Plessy B. Ferguson in 1896 to 2004 and the 50th anniversary, can you connect the two, Plessy with Brown v. Board?
Oh, sure.
Plessy,
which is a case that came up in Louisiana in 1896, came to the Supreme Court, was a case in which Plessy, who looked like a white man, and they knew he was, but they knew he was not legally white in Louisiana, when he got on the train in New Orleans, going some distance there in Louisiana, he was told that he had to sit back with the black people, and he said that he wasn't going to sit back there, and they arrested him, and he was charged with trespassing and violating the law, and he took the case to the United States Supreme Court finally.
The late Dr. John Hope Franklin, noted historian, born January 2nd, 1915, he died on March 25th, 2009, at the age of 94. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future in Black America programs, email us at lowercase jhanson, at kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.